Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 88 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion or like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. You can listen when we're first broadcast at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm. Or a day or two later, you can download us using iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, and I do like hearing from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. And with this week's guest, Suzanne Venker, who is a critic of feminism, we will definitely get some challenging ideas. So let's go to her now. Suzanne Venker is an author and feminist critic, i.e. critic of feminism. She's written books including The War on Men, The Two-Income Trap, and The Flip Side of Feminism, co-written with Phyllis Schlafly. Welcome to the show, Suzanne.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. So do you agree that women have suffered much in the past when men used their physical power to control, rape, or kill them?
So it's an interesting way to phrase the question. There will always be bad guys in the world, and just as there are bad gals. But if you're talking about as a whole, do I think women suffered greatly in the past and they're only just now coming into a fair, wonderful world? No, not at all. In fact, I'd say that we've lost a lot of power that we used to have. But it was a power of a different sort, if you will. You know, the idea that men are or women are living the same lives as men are, in seeking that kind of power, is sort of I like to say they've robbed Peter to pay Paul, in that they've lost the power that they had just being female, and what that means for them as a gender and what it used to mean.
So, what do you think it used to mean to be a woman in the in what you feel was the golden era of being a woman, wherever, whenever
well,
that was?
I don't know if I'd say that. I think today women have it better in a lot of ways, but we certainly have lost the right is not the right word, but the advantage of being held in higher regard, because women were treated. For example, this is just a small example, but, you know, men used to stand up at the table when a woman would enter the room. Men would walk on the outside of the sidewalk to protect the woman. There's a lot of little things that people don't think about that women were advantaged, if you will, due to the protections of men. So do I think men as a whole use some horrible power to keep them down or hurt them? No, of course not. I mean, of course, there's always people like that in the world. But as a whole, men cared for and protected women. And those protections are no longer really in place because we've switched things up so much and made kind of a...
It seems to me that those protections kind of extended to the middle class. I mean, I agree there's kind of an idealized chivalry that, you know, a man opens the door for the woman and all mm-hmm. this kind of thing. But, you know, if you were a poor working single mother in the 1950s, was anybody opening doors for you if you worked in the factory or
right? So it's important when you're talking about these issues. Obviously, class difference is a huge issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a separate issue, I would say, than talking about feminism specifically. You know, feminism has always been a very upper middle class issue. they're not concerned with the lower classes at all. This is about people who are in blue collar, live blue collar lives, do not have the luxury of sitting around thinking about their place in the world. They're just too busy working and making a living. So this whole conversation is really relegated to the middle or upper middle class women. That's who feminists are, and that's who they speak to.
Well, there's definitely been that criticism. Don't ask me why, but I was just reading an article by a woman claiming that in the medieval era, women were valued more because of the idea of chivalry than in the Renaissance era. But my biggest criticism of the argument is it basically used as examples only the elite women who were married to kings or owned property or were, you know, what we would now call exceedingly rich, if not royalty, and had nothing to do with a woman who was working on a farm or something like that.
Yeah, that's fine. But I just think when you're talking about feminist issues, when you originally mentioned that we're really talking about the middle class, and I'm essentially agreeing with you. That is what we're talking about. You really have to talk, if you're going to talk about class difference, then you're really getting into economics, not so much intellectual theory.
Yes. So how do you think women can best balance their biology, which is not deniable? It's only women who can be pregnant, who can give mm-hmm. birth, and who can breastfeed. How do they balance that with their life aspirations, whether that's career or other things that are not rearing children and looking after a husband?
Right. So that is, of course, at the crux of a feminist debate, whether it's today or even 30 or 50 years ago, even really 75 years ago, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's really what it's about, is that there's these two aspects to really males and females. But it's more dominant for females, or more persistent, because they are the ones, as you say, who biologically carry the child, and so they're affected very differently than a man is.
Mm-hmm.
That is an age-old issue that back before we had birth control, you were kind of screwed in that regard, right? If you had those feelings, which I think most women do, about having two sides to them, you kind of didn't have any choice in the matter, and you were kind of stuck. So when we go back to the beginning of your question, I said women are better off actually today. That is where I think that we have the advantage, is that the way the world is today, with all of our technological advances and with the birth control, obviously our opportunity to exercise that other muscle, right, is greater. And we are able to, quote-unquote, fulfill that, if you will. Whereas 100 years ago, 50 years ago, people were definitely not able to do that. But that wasn't because men were holding them down in mass force. That was because we hadn't progressed yet as a society with technology and these advances in general that allow us, just progress in general, that allow us to then look outside the home for other methods of fulfillment, if you will.
Right. I mean, do you think it's a problem when a woman, just says, career is important to me, but I also want to have children, and so has her one or two children, and then, as soon as possible, the child's in daycare, and the woman's back at work. Is that a problem for the woman, or the family, or the child, or the man who's involved
all
in her life?
Why
is that a problem?
For all of the above, because children need parents. They need a parent at home. They need mommy in the first couple of years. And that is something that, depending on your views on it, will either come first in your life or won't.
So why is it a problem to the woman, to the child, to the family, to the male partner, if there is one, that a woman basically gets back to work as soon as possible after having a baby?
So there's several different responses to that. One, the most obvious question to me, that is, why are we having children if the goal is not to be with them? That is just a glaring question. Why are you having mm-hmm. children if your goal is not to raise them? What is the point? That's number one. Number two is that children deserve to be raised by a mommy or a daddy in their home. That's what they need. That's what they want, if they could talk. And we need to recognize what those early years are all about and how significant they are for the child's overall development. And if you do understand that and you're educated in that, the answer is very obvious. If you're not, when I think a lot of people are not, becomes all predicated on the needs and wants of the woman. And that's where the problem comes in, because I'm a children's needs and rights person, not a woman's rights needs person.
Right. There's a new book out called Lactivism, which decries women who push breastfeeding too hard, like the kind of women who feel that they should be able to breastfeed in public, people who think that children should naturally breastfeed for much longer than the 6 months that's recommended by World Health Authorities. I mean, it seems that breastfeeding is a bit of a challenge because it seems like the ideal time for breastfeeding is quite a long time, much longer than any woman is likely to get for, parental leave. What are your thoughts on breastfeeding and feminism?
I don't take any position on breastfeeding per se. I mean, obviously it's better for the child, and if you can do it, great. And if you can't, you can't. But I don't have any strong feelings about that issue at all.
What about things like maternal leave? I mean, do you support the idea that I think in America there's basically no maternal leave, from mandated by the federal government? What do you think about that issue, that people should have time off compensated for by, let's say, workers by unemployment insurance or something while they're at home for the first few months?
Well, the problem with maternity leave is that it could never be long enough for what a child needs. You know, we talk about 6 weeks versus 3 months versus 6 months. I mean, you're just getting started at that point.
Mm-hmm.
What is that really doing? It's starting a process that you're going to have to then stop several months down the road. I mean, if you wanted to get really technical about maternity leave, you're looking at maybe 3 years of being off of work entirely for that bonding period, and who's going to pay for that? So then it becomes an economic issue. So no, maternity leave is not something that I obviously push for or advocate or it's not sustainable. As a society, economically, and it's basically economically, because to really do it right, like I said, you'd really need a whole 3 years off. And I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Right. And do you think this is related to gender differences in pay? Like, I mean, it's notable that there's a measurable difference with men having on average higher pay than women. Do you think this is because women do take more time out of their career, or do you think there's some other prejudices at work?
I don't think I'm understanding your question right.
Well, in the United States and most other places, the average salary of a man is higher than the average salary of a woman.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, like, what are the factors that go into that? Do you think there's some prejudice? Do you think it's because women put more priority on their children than on...
Or, are we talking about equal pay?
Yeah, equal pay. Yeah.
No, that is absolutely a result of choice, and it's been proven that it's a result of choice. There is no evidence whatsoever to prove that women as a whole are discriminated against en masse that are making them, quote-unquote, earn less than men per year. That is a direct result of the choices that most women make to opt out of the workforce periodically to care for their families. And the fact that feminists don't like that men don't do that is another issue. But the reality is that is a choice, and there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, it's a good choice. So... we don't need to mess with it.
Right. I mean, I've heard anecdotal information. I mean, let's say that a manager says, well, the men are going to be with me for their career, but if there's still companies that believe in careers like that, and the woman, she's 20, so she's going to probably take a time off to have one or two children, so I should pay the men more. I mean, do you think that happens, and do you think that's right if it happens?
No, I don't think that happens in any great form, that where someone's going to sit there and say, I'm going to pay you less, or I'm going to pay this man more because he's going to stick around longer. I think that it probably happens that they don't get hired. I think that might happen. Again, a little separate issue that we don't hear a lot about. That we just hear about this whole idea of being paid more. No, I don't think that companies specifically pay more for men because they're not going to leave, but I think they might think twice about hiring someone. And of course, we have laws against that, as you know. But it's a difficult call because there's a lot of companies who are, quote-unquote, non-discriminatory or have been in the past, and they get burned because they find that over and over, wow, it is the women who are leaving. And what do they do then? You know, if you're a small business owner and you keep hiring these people with no gender bias whatsoever of your own, and then you're hiring all these men and all these women, and the younger ones, say they're going to stick around, and then they don't because they decide they want to be at home, eventually you're going to develop a prejudice that you almost can't help because you've got a company to run, and what are you going to do about it? So it's complicated.
If you were, a single mom, say with one or two children, and your partner's disappeared for whatever reason, aren't you kind of stuck? Like, you've got to work, you've got children
Absolutely.
To support.
Absolutely. Sure.
Do you think society should support those women if for nothing other than the benefit of the children?
Yes. Well, we used to. But we have to remember that was before everything changed as far as the family. We now have 40% in America. We have 40% of women who are single mothers, and that is, again, not sustainable from an economic standpoint. Back when you had very few single mothers, because that was what you just described was an unusual situation, and that's going back as early as the 70s. It was still unusual to be right. in that boat. So you could care for them government-wise from a financial standpoint because there just weren't as many of them. Same thing with daycare. Daycare is so overblown that to enact universal daycare for millions of people who want to use it instead of the smaller numbers that we're using in the past, that changes the whole economic viability. So
right.
it's not really about what we like or want or believe should be or shouldn't be or even a moral issue, but just economically it's not sustainable.
Right. But from the point of view of those families in like the 1950s or 60s, didn't many of those women just stick it out with their partner because of the children? That was a common excuse. They got to stay because of the children, even if the guy was abusive and had other women on the side. There was no economic choice.
I'm sure there are women who made the choice to stay in a marriage that wasn't satisfying. If they were being abused, they did have a recourse. Women have been getting divorced. They even got divorced in the 1800s. It could be done. It was a lot of work. And you had to show, and for people who could, and you should be able to if there's abuse or neglect or adultery or addictions, those types of things were accounted for, and women could get divorced from
The theory always seems to be better than the practice. Many of those things are difficult to prove. Like if a guy is abusing you, if he's not generating big bruises or breaking bones, it's pretty hard to prove. And I think there wasn't a lot of concern over domestic abuse back in the 50s and 60s. And, if a woman makes a choice to stay with a husband who's far less than desirable because of the children, that doesn't make what's happening to her right, does it?
Well, no. No, of course not. And the same works in reverse for the man who stays together for the sake of his children for a woman who's not up to snuff either.
And do you know, have you looked into why are there more single mothers now? Is it because men are leaving, or is it because women are just not tolerating the men, if for whatever reasons?
So the way you phrase that suggests that one only becomes a single mother because of a bad guy.
Okay, well, explain to me what's happening.
There's no other scenario that would cause that.
Okay.
There are women who become single mothers from their own doing, from their own choice, for what a series of reasons that may not have to do with the guy being a bad guy.
A woman can have casual sex and get pregnant. But, traditionally it was the man's responsibility at that point for looking after the child that he produced 50-50 with the woman, even if he didn't want to stay with the woman. I'm just asking if you know, like, what are the reasons why women end up as single mothers? I'm not trying to be political.
There are several concrete reasons. One is that we have a government that takes care of them today that didn't back in the day. You know, before we had this ballooning government handouts, for lack of a better word, you had what's known as the family. And the traditional family that is so disparaged today or laughed at or what have you, or at least was made to feel as though it was dispensable, is really in conflict with government. You either have a system of families that take care of themselves, or you have a ballooning government. You don't have both. It's when the family breaks down that the government needs to step in. And that is what, of course, has happened over these past few decades. And so, well, more than few, 50, I mean, excuse me, five decades. If you, for example, Obama's number one base was single mothers. He talked about them before he was elected in a huge way. He talked about, he even came up with a fictional woman named Julia, I think it was, who takes her trajectory through life and shows her going through her entire life and how it's going to be paid for and taken care of from a financial standpoint. There's no man in her life. She even has children. She goes to college. She has this whole great life, but there's no man in her life anywhere along the way. No husband, ever. So she is taken care of by the government. Well, those are incentives to allow people to live without a man if you so choose, and to still have children.
First of all, I think that the support in the United States, at least, has been eroded over times ever since Ronald Reagan, not really increased. There's been, you know, workfare programs where people on welfare have to work, and there's been a lot of stories about single moms who are forced to work even though they've got young children at home and sometimes have to travel an hour or more to work every day. That's hardly, you know, living off the government largesse as you're describing. And do you really believe that women make these choices because they say, oh, well, the government will look after me?
No, not at all. I don't think anything's conscious about it. I think it's just the way that, in other words, the issue is less about that, what you just described in terms of government handouts being obvious and that's what you're going to go look for, as it is this breakdown of men, the breakdown of the family in general, which has come about because of feminism's disdain for both men and marriage. But when you have a country or a society that is so disparaging of that arrangement and is systematically tearing it down month by month, year by year, you have results. I mean, there's consequences for that, obviously.
You think men play a role? Because, I mean, it used to be, when I was a kid, you'd hear about stories of the shotgun weddings. Like, you got her pregnant, you're going to marry her, and you're going to look after the kids. And now that doesn't seem to happen. And so aren't men responsible for saying, too bad, you're pregnant, I'm going on with my life, and you can deal with the kid?
I think the sexual environment that we have today is embarrassing for both sexes. I think it is a travesty what has happened with sex and sexuality and men and women, and they are equally to blame. No, I don't see victim and perpetrator. I don't see that. I see equal participants. When I look at a man and a woman, I don't look at one as a victim and one as a perpetrator. The society does.
Right,
that's
taught. But I mean, so, whether you see it that way or not, I mean, it's really easy for a man to get a woman pregnant, and it's really easy for a man to walk away. And a woman can't really walk away from her child. There's abortion, there's adoption, but female, you know, hormones being what they are, most women, when they're pregnant, get this desire to look after the child. It's sort of innate. But the man has a lot easier time walking away. So don't they have a bigger responsibility to man up and, say they'll help somehow?
Help?
You know, like financially, whether it's through, you know, marriage or financial support or something, but if a man
well,
gets a woman...
That's assuming that the woman wants to marry him.
I understand. I'm not saying that men should be forced to marry women and women should be forced to marry men who got them pregnant, but I'm just saying that shouldn't the man have a responsibility to, you know, say, I created this child, so therefore I'm equally responsible for its occurring?
Of course. I think whoever is creating a life is responsible for that life. Yes.
But do you think feminists are responsible for men increasingly walking away from that responsibility? Wouldn't they say the opposite, that, you know, you got her pregnant, so it's your responsibility to not leave the woman in poverty?
Do I think feminists are responsible
for men walking away?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, that's very... the connection between feminism and men walking away, that's kind of interesting, because back before feminism did their thing, men didn't walk away, did they?
Well, I guess they did sometimes, but not as often, obviously.
I'm saying causally. We can't prove any link.
No, no.
Just in terms of causation, it's only been since feminism has done its thing, in other words, been really vocal over these past several decades, that has happened. So then I would say feminism allows men to walk away and encourages it. Because before feminism, they didn't walk away.
But, I mean, it seems hard for me to believe that a feminist would actually... say that. You're saying it's an unintended consequence.
They wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
They wouldn't say that. But the belief system and what they sell ends up fostering that, is what I'm saying. Of course they wouldn't say that. They would also never say they don't like men. You know? But there's a lot of things that they say or don't say that don't match what their actions are, what their beliefs are. So the bottom line is feminists don't have any... There's no pro-marriage, pro-male side to feminism. They don't encourage marriage. They don't encourage a male-female, you know, lifelong
right.
relationship. They're not pro-child. They could care less about children's rights or needs. So this is not a pro-family movement. It's a pro-woman movement. And when you have a pro-woman movement, that means by nature you have to discount the other two members of our society, which are men and children. And that doesn't work, nor is it fair.
But I mean, it seems to me that we needed somebody to stand up. I mean, we need advocates for children. We need advocates for women. I mean, do you just think it's gone too far, or do you think that anybody who says, I'm going to advocate for women, period, you know, without also advocating...
I don't think anybody needs to advocate for women today. I think women are doing more than great. I think they're swimmingly, you know, their lives aren't, I mean, it depends on what, you know, what specifically you're talking about in terms of their lives, but women are doing better today than they've ever done. How could they not? The focus has been on them for years. Men aren't doing well. Boys aren't doing well. Children aren't doing well. But sure, women are doing very well because they have feminism. And that's
so...
all feminism is about.
And so you're saying that men and children are suffering because women are doing better?
No, not because women are doing because the focus is on women solely, as though they are in need of all of these, you know, name your list, you know, needs, rights, concerns, governmental policies, you know, what have you, because they're suffering in some way. You can't possibly put that much focus and have a philosophy of women first 100% of the time and think that's going to work for the whole of society. It just works for women.
I mean, I'm not sure it's even working for women.
How do men and children gain from feminism?
Well, I mean, we've talked a lot. There's a lot of single mothers who are struggling financially because they have they get children. Therefore, if there's no... husband around or male partner of some kind, then they've got to earn money for those children, but at the same time they got to be mothers. And it seems to me that
right,
that's a pretty difficult...
Before feminism it wasn't like that. Before feminism they were married and they did have support and they did have protections. It was called a man, a husband, a family.
Right, and often together. And you know, marital abuse was was accepted. People joked about it. People would say that, you know, a man needed sometimes to keep a woman in line. So
theater wasn't going to be. No one's well, I'm not advocating for never being allowed to get divorced. I mean, there's always going to be those situations. There's going to be people who abuse one another, men and women equally. And those are sad circumstances. And yes, you get divorced when you're abused. I mean, that's never been a problem. I mean, it's never been what feminists taught that it was, which was this terrible world where women were abused by all these men, and it was going on night and day, and there was no way for them to get out of that marriage, and they needed feminists to come along and save them. That's like a fiction. That didn't happen.
What didn't happen? That men beat women in their relationship?
That there was a world, that America was this world before feminism, that was filled with terrible men that were harming or abusive to their wives, and wives were suffering until feminism came along to get them out. I mean, the idea that was, the norm, that's what I'm trying to say, as though that were the norm, that's what I'm trying to say.
I mean, do you have any statistics on domestic abuse over the last few decades? And how accurate would those statistics be? Can we really say what was happening in the 50s behind closed doors in terms of the...
You can. The information exists. The information exists. It's definitely there. You can look it up.
But, if a society wasn't taking domestic abuse seriously, there would be a lot less reports, but that wouldn't mean that it didn't exist, right? Like, could we actually really know that in the...
We know about today. We know what happened. We have the statistics for today. I can't speak to 50 years ago. I'm sure that they exist. But the statistics today are very troubling and very disarming and will probably surprise you.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was asking you to go ahead with the statistics.
One of those is that women and men abuse each other equally. What's known as violence against women should just be domestic violence, period. But that's not what we have. We have domestic violence with the assumption being that it's always male on female, when in fact it is equally female on male.
Two questions there. I mean, first of all, the average male is significantly bigger than the average female. So if the violence was bidirectional, a man is much more likely to do serious harm to a woman than a woman who hits him. But where did you get this information that women are also violent?
The problem is that the definition of violence, when feminists are using the term domestic violence, when you look up the information on how that is defined, it encompasses a whole range of behavior, only one of which is to actually strike someone.
Right.
So there's a litany of behaviors that qualify as violent, some which really shouldn't be, because, there's no way for somebody to come in and really regulate that, because it has to do with your mouth, your words, and how you abuse somebody. Yeah. So, but the reality is that when you look at the statistics on domestic violence, it's not just somebody hitting somebody. There are a litany of ways in which you can be violent within a home that do not require striking or at least pounding on or punching, or what you're describing as a man having more power over a woman, which of course he does. That assumes that men are equally, or women are not as prone to being violent as men, simply because men are bigger, which is just not true. Statistically, women are very capable of being abusive.
Okay, let's separate. I totally agree that nonviolent abuse happens. If the man comes home every day and tells the woman she's fat, she's ugly, whatever.
Even throwing things. I'm also talking throwing things, screaming in your face. I mean, I'm talking about not the punch or not a knife or not punching, but there's a whole bunch of other things, not just saying you're ugly, but also being physically intimidating with your body and harmful with your, yes, your words, but also your behaviors, even if you're not stabbing or hitting.
Right. But you do agree that men are more likely to be violent than women. I mean, that seems non-controversial.
No, not at all. I don't agree with that at all.
You just...
It's not a matter of my agreeing with it. It's a matter that the facts don't show that.
So where are you... are you getting this data from?
How are you defining violence? How are you defining it? That's where the question comes in.
Well, I was defining violence as some kind of contact. So whether you throw something, whether you punch, whether you slap, that's all violence. And if you just use your words, that's not violence. Let's just say that. So with a definition of violence that involves physical contact, are you saying that women are just as violent as men within the family?
Yes, I am. I have all sorts of research that I could give you. I can give you offline. I can give you off the phone.
Yeah.
I can point you to it. There's a film coming out this fall that you'll want to see. It's called The Red Pill, and it will discount that very argument. In fact, it's probably the best way of getting the correct information because she has compiled all of the facts that we're talking about for the past 2 years and created a film showing just that. Yeah.
Can you give me a hint as to what some of the sources are for information that shows that women are physically violent in families? Because I've never seen it.
I can point you to the place to get the information. One of them I just told you. The film's coming out this fall. It's called The Red Pill. And if you go to theredpillfilm.com, I think it is, or theredpillmovie.com, one of the two, you'll find information there. And then the other person I would point you to is Warren Farrell, whose book, The Myth of Male Power, is chock full of everything you would possibly need on this topic and many other topics regarding the same overall issue of power in men and women and all that. But in terms of domestic violence, that your sources are all documented there. It's a copious book with copious research.
Okay, I will look into this a bit more. I do agree that sometimes when things are defined too broadly, like if you define violence as including words, then you're going to sweep up a lot of women in that net because there's, you know, when it comes to...
Yes, but hold on a second. You didn't just say words. You said physical contact.
Mm-hmm. No, I was... But I guess... Okay, let me step back.
Physical
if you define...
Was slapping, punching, and... Slapping
right.
and punching.
Right.
And shoving.
I wasn't trying to redefine the term. I was just saying if other people redefine violence to include non-physical contact, so words, for example, then that will bring... I can accept that will bring a lot of women under the umbrella of violent behavior, even though that's clearly not the intent. But if it's just limited to physical contact, I still have a hard time believing that women are just as physically abusive as men, but I'll look into it more.
Well, and you and I don't define it, though, do we? That's the problem. That is how it's defined. It is all lumped in. So, yes, if you were to divide it up into separate categories, I'm sure you'll find distinction there. But currently, that is how it's defined. It lumps everything together. It's just violence.
I think it's a little... I don't know if you've dealt with the issue of consent in sex, but I've had some issues where the definition of consent is being... is being reduced. For example, there was a case in Israel where a woman had sex with a man. She later found out that he wasn't Jewish but Palestinian and said, well, I wouldn't have had sex with him if I'd known, and accused him of rape, and he was convicted. There's quite a bit occurring with sexual consent like that. I mean, it used to be if a woman said no or a man said no, then that was it. That was supposed to be the end of it, and if you went beyond that, it was rape. But now, if a woman's had a few drinks, that could be considered non-consensual, but if a man's had a couple of drinks, he seems to be responsible. It seems like there's an asymmetry there. Do you have any thoughts on that issue?
I have a lot of thoughts on it.
Okay, well...
it goes back to what I was saying before about when I was really sad about the state of sex and sexuality between men and women. It's just horrible. I mean, it's off the charts. It's a mess what we're dealing with. The question that nobody seems to ask is, how do we get here? Why are we here?
So where are we
before
when it comes to
before
sex?
Before we answer what to do about it, how did we get here?
But where are we? Where do you think we are?
Okay, where we are is where men and women, especially young men and women, we're talking really college age and post-college, you know, mm-hmm. prior to being married, are having sex willy-nilly with each other. They're drunk, and there's no boundaries. There are no standards. There's no anything. It's just a free-for-all, right? And that's how you get into these situations where it's a he said, she said, and there's no way to really prove it. And you have to get legal, get it into legal issues in order to solve it. Well, what happened before when this didn't exist?
Well,
why didn't it exist before? How did we get here?
I'm not sure that on college campuses, like just taking that as a little laboratory where you put these people at sort of the beginning of their sexual peak together, you remove the parental constraints. I mean, what's going to happen? They're going to have sex, right? And I think alcohol's been on college campuses probably even more before the age of alcohol, I think, in the States is now in many places 21. Not that that stops people from drinking, but there's maybe less drinking now than there mm-hmm. was. I don't know. But I can't believe that people weren't having sex on college campuses in the 50s and 60s, 70s.
Okay, there's two things. One is the alcohol is absolutely the number one factor.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about the whole scene and then just take the alcohol out of it, what are you left with? Right? People aren't going to be doing this. So it is the alcohol that is making the decisions so poor. So if you just remove that from the equation, you're going to have fewer people having stupid sex. That's just obvious. However, alcohol was around 10, 20, 30, 40,
right.
50, 60, 70 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have this other added piece. So what is the other added piece outside of the alcohol, which I concede is a major number one problem, but outside of the alcohol, what is different today from all those years past when there was alcohol?
Oh, tell me, what was the other piece? What is the other piece?
How did men and women handle sex back in the day?
Well,
before feminism came along.
Well, I guess...
quote, unquote, liberate women and tell them that they should all be going out and having sex with whoever they want because that's what's going to make them empowered and all of the above. What was it like?
There's kind of two things. The sexual liberation occurred with birth control, and then some of the constraints on having sex were reduced. I mean, in the 50s,
true.
If you went to college and had sex and you were a woman, then... and you got pregnant, you're going to go home in shame, and that was going to be the end of your college education, probably, unless
true.
Somebody could arrange an illegal abortion for you,
mm-hmm.
Which I'm sure happened a
mm-hmm.
bit. But once birth control came along, then there weren't
it
those constraints. But you can't blame that on feminists, right? Birth control was a separate issue.
Birth control was a separate issue, and that did change the game. That is true. However, the cultural messages that are sent are going to be the most significant factor in a woman's or man's, but since we're talking about women, choices in how they handle their lives, especially once you leave the home and your parents aren't there anymore. So what the culture teaches and how they handle sex, they meaning the messages that come through, is extremely significant. So, for example, I remember reading something that P.J. Rourke wrote about the sexual debauchery in the 60s and what utter and complete idiots and fools they were. He's now, of course, in the 70s. And you look back and he says it was absolutely mayhem. It was ridiculous. You look back and you say, how did that come to be? That is a cultural shift. That is a cultural pressure, if you will. And everybody jumps on board, and it seems real good at the time, and it's not until you grow up, really, and get older that you look back and think, what the hell was I thinking?
But I think today feminists would say, you know, women have sexual choices, and where I sometimes disagree with them is on the issue of exactly what is sexual consent. Like, if a woman's had one drink, can she consent? And why is it not symmetrical? If a man's had the equivalent amount of alcohol, why would any sex with him not be considered non-consensual? But they seem to be saying that sex should be occurring with more care, not less. That it was the sexual revolution of birth control that allowed the orgies of the 60s to occur.
Feminists are not trying to help women have less sex. I guarantee you that.
Well,
they are not concerned with women having less sex. However, you're right about there being that double standard for men in terms of the drink, or how many drinks, because for feminists, the female is always the victim. That is the underlying, it's everything with feminism. There's no way to disengage those two things. That is what it is. It's females are victims. Men are perpetrators. If that is your MO, then you're great with feminism. You're going to think it's awesome. So that's your movement. Go have it. But if you don't think that way, it's not, because it's always going to be that way.
Okay, so I mean, I can see how that plays out in the whole issue of consent, in that, say, a woman has enough alcohol to make her tipsy, or there's some standard where you say, okay, she's no longer able to consent, but that standard doesn't apply to men. If a man gets drunk and has sex with the woman on the couch,
he's still to blame.
He's still to blame, even though he mm-hmm. couldn't consent because he's drunk, right? But if a woman is, I mean, there's a case in a college in the States that I mentioned on the show before where a woman got very drunk, had sex with a man who was quite obviously even more drunk. He was unable to talk, and then later decided it was a bad idea, and he basically got kicked out of college. That seems totally unfair.
There's a lot of cases like that going on here.
Yeah, there seem to be a few cases like that.
More than a few.
There does seem to be a lack of the feeling of saying, you know, women also should be take responsibility for their sexual activities. If they know that when they get hammered, they'll sleep with anybody, then maybe they shouldn't get hammered, or decide.
Right, which goes back to what we were saying before about alcohol being the obvious the most obvious answer there is. Because if you remove the alcohol, the same choice isn't going to be made.
Right.
Except, unfortunately, we can't get alcohol out without evolution or something.
I mean, it seems to me that the societal messages are that it's okay, more okay for a man to be promiscuous than a woman. I mean, do you agree with that, that still occurs in society?
At the core of this issue with sex is that sex is serious business. That's the reality. We treat it like it's not, and it is. And if there's anything that this whole college rate, so-called rate, of the last few years, phenomenon or debacle or whatever has proven, it's that sex is serious business. And men and women do not come to bed with the same needs and expectations. That is the bottom line. We are not the same. And that is the other underpinning of feminism. It's part of their creed. Not only are women always victims, but men and women are the same. That is their, that's what they believe. And so if you start out with an inaccurate view of something, everything from there is going to be false.
But, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of factors involved. It's very difficult to tease them apart, because alcohol basically means that neither men or women are really thinking when they have sex. They feel the urge, yeah. They're drunk, they do it, and, you know, that's hardly an ideal
situation. Okay. Right. Now, remove the alcohol, and then what? Remove the alcohol from the equation. Pretend there's no such thing. We live in a world where there's no alcohol. Then what do you have? Then you have just the sex, right?
Right. And to a man,
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to a man, the consequences of having sex with a woman are much less than in the woman's case where she might get pregnant. I mean, in a more primitive society where there's no birth control and things like that. So a woman has a lot more consequences to consider when deciding who to have sex with.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Right.
With that, and that probably is reflected in biology to some extent. The consequences of being promiscuous for a woman are greater.
The physical consequences of being promiscuous, are you talking about getting pregnant?
Yeah,
of course.
I mean, our bodies tend to reflect the consequences. So, you know, would a woman be emotionally more less likely to be promiscuous? The statistics seem to show that women are less promiscuous than men.
They are less able to be promiscuous than men. They are less able to physically because their hormones are not the same as men's. Men are saturated in testosterone. Women have testosterone, but far, far less. Women's bodies are doused in oxytocin, which men have some of as well, but women are doused in that hormone, and that is what's known as the bonding hormone. And every time that you have contact with someone, that gets released, and that allows you to trust that person. That's what that hormone is all about. And so when a woman has sex with a man, and she thinks she's just going to be able to wake up and walk away the next day, she physically can't do it. It's not because she's a loser or because she's not the empowered woman that her neighbor is, who acts like having sex with all these men is empowering. It's because her body's literally not allowing her to do that.
I mean, you're basically saying it's similar with a baby. Like many women get pregnant, decide to give their baby away for adoption, but if they actually find that it's a wrenching situation because their body is bonding them with the baby, and it's almost impossible to give the baby up.
Precisely.
We've pretty much come to the end of our time. I don't know how much we've agreed on. I don't think we've drawn any grand conclusions, but it has been a very interesting conversation indeed. And I think I agree with some of your views, and I don't agree with others, but it's always interesting to challenge one's viewpoints. So I thank you for doing that.
Thank you for having me.
I did want to get into the issue of censorship, but I guess we ran out of time before we got that. But anyway, you're not censored on this show, so you can feel good about that.
Great. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Suzanne. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, so now we have time for feedback of the week. Laura on Facebook wrote, "I really enjoyed your show today on PRN. I appreciate the differing perspectives. I actually caught the show by accident a few months ago, and I think I'm a regular listener at this point." Thanks, Laura. Thanks for being a listener, and thanks for sending in such a nice comment. I would like to go back to episode 87, Holy Hormones, with Leslie Carol Botha. I agreed with a lot of what she said. Like a lot of my guests, I didn't agree with everything. But one thing I meant to respond to during the show, but it moved so fast, I never got around to it. And that was a comment that she made that seemed to be in favor of a form of eugenics. She made a comment saying that when people of lesser intelligence have children, it's a burden on society. Well, I really disagree with that. It was a little bit outside the scope of our discussion, and so it caught me a little bit by surprise. But I'd like to make a few points about this. One of the points is that intelligence is something that cannot be measured. Sure, we have IQ tests, but an IQ test is a very imperfect tool. It's very influenced culturally. It comes out of a particular culture, and so people from other cultures will have more or less difficulty with it. There is really no gold standard for an intelligence test. So imagine that you wanted to create a new intelligence test. Well, how would you verify that it was accurate? Well, you'd compare it against an IQ test. Well, how did they validate the first IQ test? Well, they would go to somebody who they thought was very intelligent and they'd score high, and they'd go to somebody who was what at those days they would call mentally retarded and they'd score low. But that doesn't really prove too much. It really doesn't prove anything about the actual accuracy. So is an 80 or 100 or 120, are they really all that different? Also, we have to consider that there are multiple forms of intelligence. I mean, how would you come up with an intelligence test that could evaluate, Mozart, Steve Jobs, and Einstein? Which of those three is more intelligent? Well, their intelligences are completely diverse. They're not at all the same. And so it would be very much a matter of opinion. If you were a musician, you might say Mozart. If you were a physicist and understood more about Einstein's theories, you may very well say Einstein. Or not, if you didn't like Einstein. But I think what it goes to show, first of all, is that intelligence is a very fuzzy concept, and actually the problem with intelligence tests are very much like a lot of medical tests, like the HIV test, for which there is no gold standard. And by gold standard, I mean something that can unambiguously determine the quantity of something present. For chemical tests, there may very well be a gold standard, a much more expensive and slower test, but one that is based on physical principles that you know can only react to the substance that you're trying to measure, such as gold. That's not true for things that are more biological, including intelligence tests and a lot of medical tests. I think a good example of the different forms of intelligence was the fact that sculptors in the Greek and Roman era created sculptures in quite a different way than those in the medieval era. They created the sculptures by in multiple pieces, and then they put them together with very sophisticated soldering so that you could not see the joints. And this way they were only actually smelting relatively small pieces of bronze or whatever they were using. But in the Middle Ages, they had lost the ability to solder. And besides, they wanted to produce things like bells that could only be produced in a single cast, that could not be produced in pieces. And so they developed techniques of sculpting very large pieces of bronze in a single pour. Now, if a Greek person was to measure the capabilities of a medieval sculptor, they would say, well, this guy's an idiot, and he could list all the things wrong with creating a sculpture in one piece. And there are problems, such as that the thickness of the bronze is more variable. And if somebody from the Middle Ages looked at a Greek bronze, they'd say, well, that guy didn't have the capability of pouring it in one piece, which is obviously the most important thing. But probably more than anything else, what's really important with families, I think, is love. And if people do have lesser intelligence, but they love each other, and they love their children, and they have the basic capabilities to bring up children, which doesn't take a huge amount of intellectual capacity, they may even turn out to be better parents than smart people who end up as alcoholics or workaholics or abusive parents. Well, that's my rant for the week. Thank you for listening to episode 88 of The Infectious Myth. You can access our archive of episodes at infectiousmyth.podbean.com. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Thanks for listening, and until next week, goodbye.